I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to The Connection. Ethan Cross's grandmother, Dora Kremen, survived the horrors of the Holocaust by staying one step ahead of the Nazis, finding refuge in the bitter cold forest, begging for shelter from strangers, and hiding from militia intent on killing Jews. After the war, Kremen and her family eventually moved to Brooklyn, where she was like a second mother to her grandson. Cross writes in his new book, Shift, that when he used to ask her why she never talked to him about the war, she replied, "Darling, don't ask why." Ethan Cross is a psychologist who was made asking why the centerpiece of his professional life. He's the director of the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory at the University of Michigan. In his new book, he argues that emotions are neither good nor bad. They are information that operates like our immune system, alerting us to danger and helping us make decisions about how to navigate the world. He joins us here in our Philadelphia studio to talk about why we need all of our emotions, how we can befriend them all. And Ethan Cross, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Well, thanks for having me here.
You're very welcome. Let's begin with your grandmother. Why was this question, why, so off-putting for her?
Well, I think the reason it was off-putting is because she had lived through such trauma that going back to it, you know, she witnessed her family be slaughtered. She narrowly escaped that fate herself. And she went on to build a wonderful life for herself here in the States. And I think, you know, I can only imagine here, but looking at me, her grandkid, like her family is flourishing, being reminded of that was likely a source of pain. And
she did have, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but she did have, and it was fascinating that once a year there was this thing, I don't know if it was informally called Remembrance Day, but where she and some of the people that she knew who had survived the Holocaust would tell stories, and they would cry and weep and wail and carry on one day out of the year.
Yeah, and that was what was so striking to me, because here I am, you know, I'm spending every day after school at her house while my parents are working. She's taking care of me. She's a hero in my eyes. I'm constantly asking her, "Bubby, tell me about the war." I used to call her Bubby.
Bubby, yeah.
And she, you know, "Don't ask why, don't ask why." And then this one day a year where she and her fellow survivors organized, like in a grassroots manner, this Remembrance Day event, they would just get into it. It was like she was dosing the ability to relive those experiences so that she didn't forget them. And then she'd go back to life as Bubby.
But you are sitting there listening to this grandmother who wouldn't tell you why.
That's right.
But listening to her at weeping about what had happened to her and other people.
That's right. You know, I went back and I watched some videos of her. The Holocaust Museum in D.C., they did this kind of oral history, and they interviewed her, and it was so interesting while I was researching the book to go back and you know, she's since passed away, watch her talk about her experiences during the war. And she uses a phrase during the interview that I was reminded of her using growing up.
Yeah.
"Don't ask why. Why is a crooked letter." There's a real beauty to that phrase. And what's interesting about it is that my grandmother, who barely spoke fluent English, had somehow, you know, got that in her repertoire. And then you want to know something. I find this to be just really puzzling. This, you know, there are lots of things about the mind that we've figured out, but the unconscious is still quite a mystery. So I had forgotten about this, you know, why is a crooked letter, went on with my life, went on to dedicate my life to basically asking why questions about how people work, how emotions work. Why?
How ironic is that, right?
Wild. But then you fast forward to the first scientific paper I ever published. The title of that paper was "When Asking Why Doesn't Hurt." So this has been in the recesses of my mind for quite a while. And you know, working on Shift was just really, really illuminating for getting me to now think about my grandmother's experience managing her emotions through a very, very different lens that I now have after being in this business for about 25 years.
In fact, you say she wasn't really avoidant. I mean, that she was able to compartmentalize. You actually have it near the very end of the book, a really lovely description of her. She wasn't particularly self-reflective. Mm-hmm. She had a house full of houseplants that sort of connected her to nature. This was, of course, in Brooklyn. She fell back on Jewish cultural traditions, such as prayer and Remembrance Day. And then you write, every lipstick-laden kiss she planted on my cheek, every sweet-smelling noodle kugel that came out of the oven were moving her emotions around in ways that I, as a kid, could not comprehend. That she figured out what she was going to do with this trauma and her emotions, and it worked for her.
That's right. And, you know, one theme of this book is that there are no one-size-fits-all solutions when it comes to managing our emotions. One of my biggest pet peeves is when I get asked, so don't do it.
Yeah, right. I won't.
You know, what is the one thing you should do to manage your emotions? There right. is no one thing. We know that different tools and different combinations of tools work for different people. And I think the real challenge for us as a species is to familiarize ourselves with the tools that are out there so that we can start figuring out what are the unique combinations that work for us. There are dozens of tools that I talk about in the book. My grandmother likely stumbled on tools that work for us. I think most of us do when we navigate this messy emotional world. We just stumble. Oh yeah, this may seem to work. But what learning about these tools has the potential to do for us is allow us not to stumble and to be more strategic in how we incorporate these tools in our lives.
And I do want to get to all of that, but your story about your grandmother reminded me, having interviewed Esther Perel's, mm-hmm. whose parents also survived the Holocaust. But I remember her telling me that she, and she's told this story before, that they were determined to live, to enjoy life, that they made this decision. You know, I don't know what it was like to live with them, but they had made this decision that they were not going to suffer anymore. They were going to live.
Yeah. Yeah. My grandmother was incredibly determined. I mean, if you think about her story, I mean, she and my grandfather, they persevered through conditions that I, to this day, have a hard time wrapping my head around. In fact, I use my grandmother's experience often as a tool to help me manage emotions. When I'm struggling with something that feels really big, I use this tool called mental time travel, where I will get in my mental time travel machine, program it up to take me back to the early 1940s, and then I hang out with Bubby and Papa for a little while in the frozen Polish woods. And I don't spend too much time there. I don't need to, because I simulate what they went through, and it instantly puts what I'm going through in perspective. So there was an incredible determination to persevere, and I marvel at it. Mm. I find it inspiring, and it is a gift in many ways that helps me manage my emotional life right now, and it's a gift I give to my kids when I remind them of my grandparents' story.
I mean, I think there are a lot of families, and maybe they have secrets, but there are certain things that you just do not ask about. And maybe even the emotions attached to that are kind of shut down. I also think there are families where the emotions are so volatile. They're all over the place. Yeah. You have to sort of navigate between people's anger and their hurt and their sadness.
Yeah.
How do we teach children about emotions and what they are and how to express them and how to befriend them, if I can put it that way?
Well, you know, it starts by talking to them about these concepts. I just finished up I just gave a presentation at a local university, and there were, you know, probably, doesn't matter, there were a lot of people in the audience, and I just asked them, how many people, would anyone feel comfortable coming up to the front with me and just answering the question, what is an emotion? And no one raised their hand.
Interesting.
Now, I find that remarkable, because we have been experiencing emotions from the moment we were born. Some argue we experience emotions in the womb of a rudimentary form. We have these experiences every day. Some research suggests that we experience emotions roughly 90% of the time that we are awake, we are experiencing emotions. And I don't know about you, but I'm often experiencing emotions in my dreams too.
Indeed.
And so we are an emotional species. They are fundamental to how we function. And I think you can ask yourself, with respect to your children, are you talking to your kids about emotions and what they are and when they're beneficial and when they're not? And when it's okay to intervene and how to do it. My oldest daughter a couple of years ago was experiencing a bit of anxiety about school. She had just moved to a new middle school, and the demands were higher. And I went into her room one night, and I can see she's visibly upset. I go, "What's the matter?" She goes, "I'm feeling this stuff in my stomach. I don't know what this is," and it was alarming her. And I just said to her, "Sweetie, that's your body telling you that you've got something important coming up. You're experiencing an emotion that's saying, hey, you've got to study a little bit and focus." And so all I did in that instance is I gave her an understanding of what an anxious reaction is, and I explained how normal and useful it can be if it's kept in the right proportions. That's a gift we can give to all our children.
Well, I have to confess that I Googled, what are emotions? And there's disagreement.
But, there's a lot of disagreement.
There's a lot of disagreement. But the one that kept coming up were the six, I guess, big ones: sadness, happiness, fear, anger, surprise, and disgust. If from your perspective, should we add some more emotions to that, or will that serve?
We should probably add some more emotions to that. You know, the big debates in the field right now, which are true debates with evidence on both sides, have to do with whether there are a finite number of discrete emotions or whether they come in an infinite number of blends. There are some debates about how universal different kinds of emotions are, how culturally constructed they are. It's a lot.
It is.
And so my approach in the book, and really what I find most interesting and what I've devoted my life to studying, is, well, first of all, what is it that we agree on when it comes to emotions? And there is a lot we agree on. They're responses to events in the world or events we imagine that are meaningful to us. And when we encounter those kinds of situations, we experience this loosely coordinated response that is designed to help us deal with the situation at hand. So loosely coordinated, things are happening in your body. Your thoughts are being guided in particular ways. There's a subjective experience you often have. Your facial muscles may contort to display an emotion. Like, what am I showing to you right now?
Right. You're smiling.
There we go. So are you. That feels great, right? Like, I can register that. So that's not controversial. You know what else isn't controversial? The notion that sometimes these emotions, which across the board, even the bad ones, are useful for us in the right proportion, sometimes we experience them in an out-of-proportion manner. They get the best of us. And that when that happens, it's really important to understand how to rein them in or amplify them. And that is the focus of my work and the book.
Indeed. Well, I do want to talk more about emotions, including the controversial ones. And again, Ethan Cross is our guest on The Connection today. And he's got a new book. It's titled Shift, and it's subtitled Managing Your Emotions So They Don't Manage You. And he is a psychologist at the University of Michigan. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with psychologist Ethan Cross. He's director of the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory at the University of Michigan, and he's got a brand new book. It's titled Shift, Managing Your Emotions So They Don't Manage You. So we could dig deep into this controversy about how many emotions and blah, 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 blah. But nonetheless, what about some of these more controversial emotions that you referenced?
Well, controversial emotions are just emotions that are less common in the States, for example, like the notion of Schadenfreude.
Oh, yeah, Schadenfreude.
Finding joy in other people's misery.
Yeah.
That's an interesting one.
Right.
And so, you know, we don't necessarily have a word for that in our culture. And there are certain groups that talk about the importance of language for our emotional experiences and having having a corpus of language to describe our emotions right. can sometimes be useful for carving out unique spaces within particular emotional domains.
Well, let's take a basic emotion like anger.
Yeah.
Is your anger different from my anger? I mean, here's where language will fail me, but how is it different? How is it the same? I mean, I might know you're angry because you're yelling at me, or you've got a certain kind of look on your face, or your body language.
Yeah. This is an age-old question, yeah, right? Like, is my perception of the color blue the same as your perception? And there's no question that there can be variability in our experiences of these emotions, I believe. But I also think that there's a common profile that characterizes an anger response or a sad response. For example, we tend to experience, there's a particular pattern of what we call appraisals that track with anger. So you experience anger when you perceive there to be some violation of your sense of how things should work.
And a sense of injustice.
A sense of injustice. And there's an opportunity to fix it. You can do something about it. So when those conditions are met, you experience this emotion of anger. And maybe it manifests slightly differently in you than it does in me. But this is a useful response in that situation because it motivates you to take action, to focus, right? So I see my kid ride her bike without her helmet. I experience that's an injustice for me. That's right. Not the way it works. I want my kids to be safe. I've taught them about how to be safe. And so I might experience this anger response. My daughter will perceive it. Hopefully it will correct the situation.
Right.
So there are, you know, there are shades of that might vary between us, but I think we can agree that that's a commonality across our experiences of anger in that situation, in that instance.
You reference, and I think it is true, that we often use emotion and feeling interchangeably.
Yeah.
And not to get too technical here, but it's interesting that from your perspective as a scientist, as a psychologist, that they actually are different. And it's important to know the difference.
Yeah, and we can get as technical as you like. I love to geek
out. You do.
I love it. Yeah,
now you
that's
look
great.
Extremely happy.
There you go.
Right.
You do too. So maybe we should listen to our feelings.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, emotions, that's an umbrella term that captures, so that's a response, and there are lots of different components to an emotional experience. Things happening in your body. You may be thinking in a particular way. The feelings are the subjective component of an emotional response. It is the part of that emotional response that you are aware of. There are things happening within you that you aren't aware of. Patterns of neural activity, you have no awareness. That's still part of an emotion. It's almost like if you think about being sick. Mm-hmm. When you are physically ill, there are many things happening in your body, right? Your immune level counts are changing. You're not aware of that, but you're aware of the fever and chills you're experiencing. Feelings are the fever and chills of an emotional response.
You also say, and I think this is helpful, is to think of our emotions as a kind of immune system. That is how we navigate in the world. What is safe? What is dangerous?
Yeah, emotions. So I think all emotions are useful, right? When they're activated in the right proportions. And, you know, it's really interesting. When I was writing Shift, I had some sense of what findings and messages might really resonate with people. But then there's this other message that I have found has had huge resonance, and I had no idea it would have this effect, and it is this. If you experience negative emotions, lots of people think that if they just have that feeling of anger or anxiety or sadness, there's something wrong with them because we should only be living lives filled with positivity. What the science says and what I genuinely believe is that if you experience negative emotions at times, there's nothing wrong with you. There's everything that is right with you. These emotions are gifts. Anxiety helps me prepare for important situations. When I don't experience that before a really important situation, it doesn't go as well as when I do. Not to say that when I experience that emotion too intensely or for too long, it can handicap me. It certainly can. But in the right proportions, I really value those negative experiences. Hmm.
I grew up in a family where it wasn't a rule, but where people didn't get overtly angry. There weren't raised voices. And the kind of joke, at least for me and for my siblings, was we could tell if someone was angry with how they held their fork.
Mm.
Because, you know, everything was sort of had a tight lid on
it. Yeah.
And just the way they were holding their fork told us everything.
So interesting. And it's almost like spilling out of them, which is to say it wasn't that no one ever experienced anger, but they didn't necessarily display it. And that is a culturally determined process too, as you just very eloquently captured in your family.
Yeah. And part of what I've had to is learn how to be angry and to be okay with it. And it's been a struggle, to be perfectly honest with you.
And have you found instances in which displaying anger can be useful?
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
It's a learning process.
Sometimes, right? And that's true. Like, take another fun one, envy.
Right.
Like, do you ever experience envy?
Oh, indeed.
It's one of the deadly ones, right?
Yeah,
the deadly sins.
Yes.
Have you ever benefited from experiencing envy?
Not that I'm aware of.
I have.
You have?
Yeah.
Okay. How?
So I have found it motivating. And this is a reframe. So social comparisons, which are what drive envy, we often hear you shouldn't compare yourselves to others, right? That's another common maxim. I have been guilty of saying that to my kids. Good luck.
Yeah.
Because social comparisons are part of how we work as a social species, right? They help us. We compare ourselves to others on dimensions we care about when it's not clear where we stand. So this is just how we navigate the world, how we make sense of ourselves. Inevitably, we come across comparisons that may elicit some envy and make us feel bad. And if you're on social media, you know, it's like navigating a minefield. It's just a matter of, you know, it's not a matter of if, it's when, right? Mm-hmm. So what I do when I experience envy is, and this is out of, you know, the literature, like the science supports this, is I will experience the envy, oh, doesn't feel great. And then I will flip it. I will shift it. I will reframe it and think, oh, if this person who's like me was able to do this, so can I.
Right.
And then it's actually motivating me to attain that goal. So envy can have this motivating positive function if you reframe it.
Well, your book is called Shift, and in many ways it is about reframing things, taking your attention and shifting it to in another direction so you can, I guess, learn but also manage and maybe control.
Yeah, so I use the term shift to talk about how you can skillfully push your emotions around in the direction you want them to be pushed around. And that can refer to increasing or decreasing the volume on the emotion you're experiencing.
Like how intensely you're feeling?
How intensely. Sometimes we want to intensify things. Sometimes we want to turn the volume down. Sometimes we want to shorten the duration of our emotions. We don't want to spend as much time in that state, right? I don't want to spend a whole lot of time in anxiety, right? Other times I might want to lengthen the amount of time I spend in an emotion. Like maybe I want to maximize the time I'm spending in experiencing joy. Maybe I want to shift from experiencing one emotion, sadness, to another emotion altogether, joy. And so shifting covers that entire terrain. Reframing, that's one example of how to shift. That's one, I call it a shifter. But we have many, many different shifters. And a lot of them are plainly obvious to people, but they're just not aware of it. They're almost hidden in plain sight.
Well, give us one.
Music.
Yeah, I was thinking of music.
Music is a powerful shifter. And I find this research just so beautiful. Do you listen to music?
I do.
Why do you listen to music?
Oh, just the joy, you know,
Stop. That's all I needed to know.
Yeah, yeah.
The joy.
Yeah.
Right? You listen to music because you like the way it makes you
even
feel.
Even sad music.
Even sad music.
Good.
Music can push our emotions around in all different directions. Most people, when they are asked this question, why do you listen to music? They say something to the effect of, I like the way it makes me feel. But
right.
If you look at what they do to manage their emotions, last time you were angry or anxious or sad, what did you do? Only between 10 and 30% report using music as a tool. I was guilty of not using music as a tool to shift me before I knew about this work. Now that I do, I have playlists that I turn to amplify or diminish my emotions or get me into a different state. And it is a powerful kick in the emotional butt to activate those playlists. Like, it really works. That's an example of a sensory shifter.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Ethan Cross, our guest today on The Connection. He wrote a book a couple of years ago called Chatter, about the voices in our heads that are talking to us all the time. And his new book is titled Shift, Managing Your Emotions So They Don't Manage You. I mean, I think music makes a lot of sense, and I think people listening can say, yeah, absolutely. I mean, even if you listen to Leonard Cohen and his songs about dying,
yeah.
you know, there's still something so beautiful and joyful in a sort of weird way. But what about other, I mean, you can't always do that. You know, if something is truly upsetting.
Absolutely.
You know, you can't just sort of flip on your playlist and make it go away.
Well, and you know, the effects of sensory shifters like music, but there's also, you know, all the senses, taste, touch, smell, and other sensory modalities, they can also push our emotions around. But those effects mm-hmm. tend to be kind of short pushes. They're not terribly long lasting. Sometimes I like to remind people that a short push, you know, to lower or raise the volume on your emotions can be useful for breaking you out of a funk mm-hmm. and getting you to use other kinds of shifters. But you don't have to restrict yourself to one modality. There are many, many different kinds. So attention is another one, right? Are you going to focus your attention on the problem and try to work through it? Are you going to focus away and try to avoid it? Hmm. Or are you going to go back and forth between the two poles? We tend to talk about attention as an either or, right? You should never avoid your problems. In fact, and this, my grandmother goes back to my grandmother. She's a great example of someone who she was flexible. She would take time away from her problem, not think about it. But then she would go back. Like if she encountered someone who from her community who also survived and they wanted to talk about it, she would talk to them about it. So she wasn't just avoiding across the board. She was moving back and forth. And I have benefited from that flexibility personally time and again in my life. So one thing I've discovered, for example, is if I get into an argument with my partner, my initial reaction might be to just confront the situation right then and there. Let's just figure it out, get to the bottom. That doesn't always work.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes forcing myself to take some time away, a couple of hours, maybe even a day or two, and then come back to the problem, it is like magic. Because I come back to the problem, the intensity has subsided, so we can talk about it more constructively, and I often have like the ability to look at it with my partner from a broader perspective. That is me being very agile with my use of this attention shifter. I'm avoiding for a bit and then I'm coming back. And I think if we embrace that need for flexibility, that can serve a lot of people well.
I remember interviewing you on Chatter and you had a interesting piece of advice when we're talking to ourselves, which we are all the time, that if we talk to ourselves in the third person,
yeah.
that it's actually more effective. And I wonder with emotions, if we are talking to ourselves in the third person saying, no, Marty Moscow-Aim, you shouldn't be angry all day
yeah.
long about X, Y, or Z.
Yeah, that's a type of self-talk. We call it distant self-talk. It's another useful tool. I call that a perspective shifter. So, you know, you can think of it attention as these attention shifters. Imagine you have a camera. It's where you're pointing the lens. Mm-hmm. Is it on the problem or away? Sometimes we've got to stare our problems right in the face. We can't turn away for a variety of reasons. But what we can do is we can change the focus, the zoom on the lens. And so that's shifting the perspective. And this really gets into this idea of changing the way you think to change the way you feel, which we hear about so often. But as one of my good friends once said, and I will never forget this moment, I mentioned it in the book, we're driving home from dinner one night in Detroit. He's bemoaning a problem at work. And his wife looks at him and says, why can't you just think about it more positively? And he looks at her, he pauses, and he goes, yeah, easier bleeping said than done. It's not always easy to change the way we think, to change the way we feel. That's where a tool like distant self-talk comes into play. Using your name, Ethan, what are you going to do about this? It gets us to relate to ourselves like we're giving advice to someone else. And one of the things we know, it is much easier to give advice to other people than it is to ourselves. Have you experienced that?
Indeed, yes.
It's amazing. Like
yeah.
We can be so wise when it comes to other people, but then we say things to ourselves that we wouldn't say to our worst enemies. And so that's how one of the ways this tool works. It gets you to think about yourself like someone else.
I wonder, too, about memories and emotion and just thinking about experiences, again, I'm going to talk about myself, but I do remember this book triggered for me an eighth grade teacher, Mrs. Morton, who did not like me.
Sounds bad already.
Yeah, she did not like me, and she was mean to me, and I, you know,
shame
didn't do
you,
well
Morton.
In her class. But I can think about her now, and I am frightened, I am angry, I'm ashamed. All those emotions are right there.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think about her very much, but when I do, there it is.
Yeah, so this gets to this idea of we have these mental representations of different experiences that we have in the world, and these representations, think of it like as a snapshot of an experience, and part of that experience is often infused with emotion. So if you think back to the time that my first child was born, it was a difficult pregnancy, and I think back to the actual labor experience, it was one of the most emotional experiences in my adult life. And if I access that memory now, there's still some emotionality that accompanies it. And actually, if my wife is reminded of it, she immediately tries to change the topic to move to something else, because it's even more painful to her. Now, here's the thing. Some might argue that in those instances, the reason you're still experiencing emotion is because you haven't properly processed the experience. You haven't come to terms with it in ways that have led you to move on. But another perspective is, well, maybe we have these experiences, these memories are still emotional, but they're not seeping into our awareness on a regular basis. They're not causing any problems. So do we need to actually dredge up every single experience to you know, work through it?
We're almost having a break here, but would rumination then be the sort of dividing line there? If it's something we're ruminating, obsessing
exactly.
over?
Exactly. And one of the things I try to do in the book is, you know, the science here, I'm a geeky scientist. I find this stuff so interesting. But I try to be really pragmatic and tactical here and give guidelines for when you know whether a shifter is working or not. And you just hit the nail on the head. If you find that you're trying to take some time away from an experience, but the thoughts keep on reverberating back, that's a cue that what you're doing isn't working. And it's a cue to then try a different kind of shifter, of which there are many.
Well, let's take that very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Ethan Cross, and he's a psychologist at the University of Michigan. In fact, he's director of the Emotion and Self-Control Lab at the University of Michigan. He's written a couple of books, one that came out a couple of years ago called Chatter, the new one titled Shift, Managing Your Emotions So They Don't Manage You. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with psychologist Ethan Cross. He's got a new book, Shift, which we have been talking about, subtitled Managing Your Emotions So They Don't Manage You. And we've been talking about the fact that we can easily get overwhelmed by our emotions, but he tells us we need all of them, the so-called good ones and the bad ones, in order to live a well-lived life and maybe a well-loved life as well. Let me ask you, though, about, I mean, we began by talking about your grandmother and her trauma of surviving the Holocaust, but I'm thinking for a lot of people today, even living with trauma, that especially if you're a child, you know, how do you, not everyone can be maybe as resourceful as your grandmother can be, but for some people it really is a lifelong struggle to manage your emotions having unresolved trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if there are instances in which you find that you're trying out these different tools, these different shifters to help you live the life you want to live. I mean, I define emotion regulation as the ability to align your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors with your goals. So it's all about what kind of life you want to live. Right. And if you find that you're experiencing problematic emotions for more than 2 weeks, then that can be a clue to maybe ramp up the intervention and talk to someone, a mental health professional. Mm-hmm. And often what they'll be able to do is provide a more intensive form of intervention. It may not actually conflict with anything here, but it's just a more concentrated dose. And so, you know, other people can be a remarkably helpful tool for helping us manage our emotions if we talk and engage with the right people. And certainly mental health professionals are trained to do that, but there are also people in our network, some sure. of whom that fit that criteria. So tools you can use to shift on your own, that's only part of the shifting toolbox. There are also other people, there are environments, there are cultures. It gets a lot more elaborate.
Are certain emotions more contagious than others?
That's a great question. I don't know what the contagious index is for yeah. every emotion, and I don't know what it is because it doesn't exist. we're still struggling to define how many emotions there are. But what we do know is that emotions are highly contagious. Mm-hmm. And I think understanding that gives you a huge edge as a leader and as a human being. Emotions spread within a matter of seconds, and there's good reason for that. When we find ourselves in situations that we're not necessarily familiar with, we reference other people to get information. So how should I behave? Knowing what I know about emotional contagion, if I walk into a room and I see a group and I see there's one person who's maybe scowling and is not really very happy, I'm going to focus in on them. And, hey, how was your weekend? What's going on? Are you upset? You know, trying to make sure that emotion doesn't quickly spread. It's a really powerful phenomenon.
Yeah. I'm also thinking about how you can be watching a movie or a TV show or reading a book and be so emotionally moved. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
And maybe it's part of our imagination or our need for connection.
Well, it's also part of our senses. So, right. you know, watching a movie is a very rich sensory experience. I'll often do an exercise when I'm teaching. I'll play a funny... like a sitcom snapshot, but I'll do it without the canned laughter.
Oh, right.
And it really changes the entire emotional experience. So sometimes I'll do this exercise in classes where I'm teaching people about sensory shifters, how our senses shift us, and I'll purposely design a sequence of sensory experiences to push people's emotions around in different directions. So first I lecture for like 20 minutes, I get, and then I have people rate how they're feeling.
Yeah,
and you know, it's not looking
bored.
Great for me. I must right. say, it's slightly above the midpoint okay. on the positive dimension, but not as high as I'd like. Then I bring in pizza, and I have them take a bite of pizza, and you see their positive emotions skyrocket from that gustatory experience. Then I play a clip from a Pixar movie, the movie Up, and it's a sad clip about this aging character who loses his partner, and then I have them rate their emotions again, and you see it goes way down.
Yeah.
And then there's my favorite part of this exercise. I play the University of Michigan fight song, and I have them close their eyes and just listen. And what happens then, it really does feel like magic. I see students who have never participated once during the semester, and they are bopping, they're dancing, they're moving around, and they rate their emotions again. Their positive emotions are skyrocketing. That is how powerful our sensory experiences can be. And so when yeah. you take something like a movie, this is a sensory bomb of an experience.
You referenced this earlier, but I just want to underscore it. So all day long in our waking and maybe even in our sleeping, dreaming life, we're just constantly...
Feeling
things. Obviously, our brain is going a mile a minute as well. So it's just this conversation, feeling.
Emotions are fundamental to who we are as a species. This wonderful study, over 10,000 people, 65,000 observations, track people over time, text message people throughout the day to find out, what are you feeling right now? Check which of these emotions you're experiencing. Over 90% of the time, people report feeling something.
Hmm.
Think about like what makes life worth living.
Right.
It's the emotional events. So we're constantly bathed in these emotional experiences. I think we ought to understand what we can do to push them around.
But I wonder, maybe you referenced this earlier, but I wonder whether we too often think of like good emotions and bad emotions, that the good ones are... I want to be happy, you know, I want
absolutely.
To, all of that. And the bad emotions, obviously, sadness and anger and some of the things we've been talking about.
And the piece that, you know, I think I referenced this earlier, that is that I find personally liberating when you embrace the idea that all emotions are useful, even the bad ones, is you experience anger, anxiety, whatever it is, nothing wrong with you.
Right.
This is how we're built to be. You know, just to really convince you and maybe listeners about the utility of our negative emotions, let me just give you the example of physical pain. Do you like experiencing physical pain?
I do not.
I do not either. I'm an outlier on the scale of people who do not like physical pain.
You really
don't
like it.
I really don't like it, okay?
Fair enough.
I appreciate it. I don't want to live a life without it. And here's why. There are people born into the world who never experience physical pain due to a genetic anomaly. If you look at what happens to those people, they die younger because they get their hand caught in the stove and nothing tells them, nothing communicates that they should remove the hand, right? They scratch the mosquito bite endlessly until it's infected. They're not experiencing any pain response to help them. Pain can be useful. It is useful, just as all of our negative emotions are. And I go over the ways that different negative emotions are useful in the book.
I was thinking, too, I think it's called Williams Syndrome, where people are just happy all the time.
Mm.
And they sometimes think dogs might have Williams Syndrome because they seem so happy all the time.
Yet it's a syndrome.
Right, which tells us there's something off about it.
Yeah, you know, in one story, it didn't make its way into the book, but I interviewed a woman who also had a genetic condition that prevented her from experiencing negativity. It was a wild case. And she was very pleasant to speak to.
I bet.
But it got her in trouble at times. You know, her child was in a very, very bad accident. And she should have been distraught in a way that would have gotten her to attend to this very quickly. And she wasn't. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's liberating to embrace the fact that just give yourself grace if you experience these negative emotions at times. That's we evolve the capacity to do so for a reason. But be alert to when these negative experiences are ceasing to be functional. And when you have that recognition, that's when you want to take steps to intervene and shift.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Ethan Cross, our guest today on The Connection. And again, we're talking about his new book titled Shift, Managing Your Emotions So They Don't Manage You. You describe an experiment in this book, which even as I talk about it, my hands are sweating because it involves a snake. Give us the short version of what this experiment was about and what does it tell us about our emotions?
Well, this experiment, what it did is it recruited people. This was a classic study who were snake phobics, petrified of interacting with snakes, and it was affecting their lives. And what the researchers did, a guy by the name of Val Bandura, was essentially prodded the subjects to interact with the snake so that they would learn that doing so wasn't going to lead to the terrible outcomes that they expected. What he found in the study, though, is as the subjects began to recognize that, oh, these snakes aren't going to kill me if I even drape it around my neck, it enhanced their sense of self-efficacy, this notion that they could handle this situation, and that there was a cascade of effects, some spillover effects from that. They began to realize that they could do other things too. And once they had this understanding that they were capable of accomplishing and doing difficult things, that led to wonderful outcomes in their lives. And so there's this huge literature now on this idea of self-efficacy. Mm-hmm. It's a really good thing. Now, the reason I tell this story and the connection to emotion is this. There are lots of people who don't think they can manage their emotions. Emotions just happen. How can you possibly control them? That is a belief, if you have it, that doesn't bode well for the future in the following sense. If you don't think you can control your emotions, why on earth would you ever try to do so? Doesn't make sense. Now, it is important to recognize that there are facets of our emotional life that we do not control. So the people who believe this, there's a part of our experience that corresponds to that idea, right? Like have you ever brushed up against someone on the streets of Philadelphia who maybe didn't smell very nice?
Oh yeah, sure.
And you experience an emotional reaction?
Yes.
Unpleasant smells. Normal human experience.
Right.
You ever come in contact with someone who smells wonderful from a cologne or a perfume?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we don't determine. Those are just automatic reactions. Sometimes we have dark thoughts that we don't know why they've come into our consciousness. You can't control that. But what you can control is what happens next. How you engage. You can control the trajectory of those emotional responses. And so giving people this notion of self-efficacy with respect to their emotional lives is tremendously important. I genuinely believe I can control my emotions, and it dictates what I do next.
Let me ask you about learned helplessness. And this is when you get, I mean, it's based on some experiments of shocking animals, and then they kind of give up. But I guess the idea that you just get knocked down at every turn, and it, eventually people sort of give up.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
They just kind of throw their hands in the air. How can shifting, I mean, if we've given up, then we feel powerless. We don't have kind of self-esteem. We don't have this self-efficacy that you were talking about. How do we reshift? How do we shift and feel empowered?
Well, that's why I start the book. An early chapter deals with this concept of self-efficacy.
Yeah.
If you don't think you can, you very likely aren't going to try. And so step one is to recognize that we can always shape the trajectory of our emotional responses. That is our playground, right? And I think once you have that recognition, that counteracts the helpless response. And then it opens up the door. So you're reframing it there,
right?
Like, no, I can manage. I may not be able to manage the thoughts that automatically pop up, but whether I elaborate on those thoughts, whether I act on them. Like, did you punch the person who didn't smell good?
No.
Did you curse them out?
No.
Did you say, take a shower?
No.
You didn't do any of that because you had the ability to control it. And pointing this out for people, pointing out that distinction, I find can be really helpful.
I wanted to, this may be a too overtly political question, but I think a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people feel a kind of learned helplessness, worried about democracy, you know, worried about what our government is doing, feeling that that whoever is in charge is not in charge. So there is a kind of helpless feeling out there. What do you suggest people do? And some people say, well, I'm just not going to watch the news. I'm just not going to engage in the world. I'm going to disappear. Is that helpful? Is that healthy?
Well, it depends on if it's serving the person's goals. I can tell you that I've minimized my exposure to some news. And, you know, I'm not ignorant of it, but I'm not checking every day. And I find that can be useful. You can also broaden your perspective. Try to look at the bigger picture and, you know, look at this in the broader context of society and elections, and, you know, there's undulations. And of course, what I'm talking about now with these tools, this is not specific to one political party. This is specific to human beings.
Right.
People on both sides of the spectrum have issues that provoke them. And I think these tools are relevant to all of them.
We're here in Philadelphia, and the Super Bowl is just a couple of days away. The city is decked out in green, and I'm curious about the emotions of fandom. I mean, I think people are excited, they're nervous, they're everything all at once.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny you bring that up. A couple of months ago, I went to a Taylor Swift concert with my family, and in true dorkhood fashion, right? There, everyone's just dancing and. And I'm looking around, I'm thinking, my goodness, how many millions of dollars were just spent in this stadium to have an emotion regulation experience?
Yeah.
With this one person on stage who's just playing our emotions in a wonderful direction. And sporting events are I think, of a very similar ilk, right? These are incredible emotional experiences. And I mind you, it's complex. Right? Our emotions are going up and down. We are going to be on the edge of our seats maybe and biting our nails, you know, figuratively speaking. And we love it.
Yeah.
And that goes back to this idea about emotions are fundamental to our lives. And so let's start giving ourselves emotional experiences that are in concert with the lives we want to live.
And again, we're almost out of time here, but you can be optimistic and pessimistic at the same time, right?
Well, yeah, and there could be some utility to that too, right? So focus on the big picture and the goals, but also be realistic about what the obstacles are. Balancing those two can be really helpful.
Well, go Birds.
I'm pleading the fifth.
Fair enough.
You're
from Michigan.
Michigan, yeah. Good luck.
Ethan Cross, our guest, thank you so much. Thanks for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And again, his book is titled Shift, Managing Your Emotions So They Don't Manage You. And he is director of the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory at the University of Michigan. Debbie Bilder, the producer of The Connection, along with Paige Murray-Bessler, Al Banks, and Diana Martinez, our engineers today. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.